Hello, friends. Welcome to episode number 4 of the Quiz Shrine podcast. Today, we welcome as a guest Rachel Dispenser from Coping Skills, successful tour manager for artists such as Mannequin Pussy. Rachel, it's so nice to have you on. Please introduce yourself.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, my name is Rachel. I am a non-binary person. I'm a tour manager, a merchandise manager, sometimes a musician and a songwriter, and recently a podcaster.
That's a lot of things you do. I'm really excited to have you on. I honestly can't wait to ask you a million questions. I wrote a whole A4 sheet of questions down today.
Oh, cool.
I'm going to see whether I'm going to be able to squeeze them in. Anyway, so for those of you tuning in for the first time potentially on the Quiz Shrine podcast, we invite marginalized artists and crew to talk about breaking into the music industry, growing as an artist, finding crew gigs, and more. How did you kind of get into touring work especially?
Sure. I started going to shows when I was in high school still. I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania in like a small town. And so some friends and I would drive about like 30 to 45 minutes were the closest places where we could see shows. There was a movie theater that did shows about 20 minutes from my house. And I just really fell in love with being at concerts. And when I was a senior in high school, I booked a benefit show for To Write Love on Her Arms, like in the middle school auditorium as a senior project.
Right.
And then when I moved to Philadelphia for college, I started going to house shows here. And I made a friend with this guy, Ruben, who has been booking for a long time. And he taught me a lot about what it means to be part of a community and to take care of people. And I graduated college with a music business, entrepreneurship, and technology degree. Too many words in a degree, if you ask me. But that's what you get for getting a bachelor's of science at an art school. And I really wanted to start touring. Actually, the first tour I went on was with Ruben's band, Soul Glow. They took me on a 3-day like weekend run to sell merch, and I fell in love with it and knew I just wanted to keep doing it.
That's fantastic. To be honest, I'm kind of jealous of all the work that you've been doing so far. Just the little list you sent me in an email, like I can't help but pretty much straight away ask, how the heck do you get into working with, you know, artists such as Mannequin Pussy, Bully, Japanese Breakfast, Warriors, and loads more? Yeah, if you wouldn't mind just kind of going into some of those stories and like how that came about.
Well, it's as simple as I just put myself out there and did the work. I met Mannequin Pussy my senior year of college. My bandmate, Lauren, and I, before we were in a band, we went to college together, and for our senior project there, we put together a compilation called Girls to the Stage, which was a comp of 6 either primarily or entirely female artists in Philadelphia, and we recorded all 6 tracks ourselves, and we mixed them, and we put out the compilation on a tape on a label our friend Steph ran called Girls Cartel Records. And then we threw a record release show at First Unitarian Church here and donated all of the money from all of that to Girls Rock Philly. And Mannequin Pussy was on that comp. And like a few months after about a year after I graduated college, I had put it out on Facebook that I wanted to start tour managing and would anybody be interested or willing to take me? And Marissa from Mannequin Pussy just commented, yes.
That's really good.
Yeah. I was like incredibly surprised because I thought that they didn't really enjoy the recording process with us. So Lauren and I had still had a few things to learn, and there were a couple things that we were having trouble figuring out, and there were problems with the mix, but a couple of days into my first tour with Mannequin Pussy, I had said to Marissa, you know, I'm surprised you wanted to have me here. And she was like, oh no, it's because of that experience that I wanted to hire you, because you guys worked really, like, you worked really hard. You were willing to hold your ground. Like, there was a situation where at one point they had asked if we would let them have somebody else mix the track. And we were like, no, we're doing this. It's our project. Like, where can we compromise? And they wound up using that song as a demo to re-record for Romantic. So it just, like, worked out everywhere.
Wow. That is really, really cool. Like, Mannequin Pussy at this point is quite a big band, to be fair.
Yeah, they're the best band.
Did you, by the way, tour manage the non-US American tours as well?
No. It costs too much money to bring an extra person out there. And you have to hire, like, drivers when you're in Europe to begin with. And so it just makes sense to cut costs. A lot of bands lose money on European tours because the expenses are so high.
Oh, yeah, that is something that I do hear a lot of the time, obviously. So just for context, I'm in Europe, I'm in Austria, actually, and Quizfront booking did actually start in Europe, mostly kind of like going with the market of American bands coming over and needing a driver, a tour manager, a booking agent in the first place.
Oh, cool.
And that's kind of where we do come in and try to cut those costs, but I also don't want to make this podcast episode a marketing opportunity for for the booking agency.
It's all good. Support the brand. Yeah.
Either way, yeah. You know, I'm just going to be a little fangirl right now and say, you know, maybe Mannequin Pussy listened to this episode and go like, hey, we should totally work with this amazing agency in Europe.
When touring eventually comes back.
I was kind of going to ask this question later, but now that you sort of brought it up, I wonder, how have you adapted with the whole pandemic situation so far? Also, like, not just asking for a friend, but literally asking for myself, because I'm a tour manager and booking agent and loads of more things myself. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I still haven't adapted one bit, even like 8 months in. Have you kind of found a way, or like, have you got a job to fall back on, stuff like that?
I don't have a job to fall back on. One of the hardest things about this has been that I was coming up on about a year of not having a job in Philadelphia. I was sustaining myself fully on touring work, which has been even harder because I have a lot of loans. I have a lot of student loan debt. I remember my first tour of this year, I do merch for the band Whitney, and we were on the beach in Miami in early February. And I was like, wow, my whole year is almost booked out already. This is incredible. I can't believe I'm here.
Wow.
And then like 3 weeks later, it was all gone. I can't tell if I'm either handling it super well or it's just buried deep and waiting to crack one day.
Right. Yeah.
Overall, I've been okay. I've been really lucky that I've had some of the bands that I work for have been pretty financially supportive of their crew, which I think is just a testament to what incredible people they are. And it makes me feel really lucky that they've chosen me to work for them.
Yeah.
But I miss it. This is the longest I've been in like a decade without going to a show. It feels bizarre.
Wow. Yeah. There was actually one band from the US as well that ended up leaving their 50% commission off the whole European tour, including driving, tour management, stuff like that with us.
Oh, wow.
Even though it's not really clear whether they're going to kind of make it to Europe within the next, let's say, 2 years.
Yeah.
So, and it was kind of a large sum of money. And yeah, I could fully relate to feeling incredibly lucky. And the best thing about it is too that the money didn't just go to me in person as the person that would have tour managed and tour driven and done all the stuff mostly by myself, but also in that case the social media manager that was working with us at the time, and so she got a 30% cut that we had in the contract, stuff like that. So yeah, the money actually went to different people on the team in the end, and I think helped loads
yeah.
in the situation that everybody is in. I mean, I only this week really started to look into stationary jobs again. Like, I haven't really lived in one place for, I know, over a year, more like 1.5 years at this point. And I've just always been touring, and then I eventually bought a van and like moved into the van because it just didn't make sense to rent somewhere.
Sure.
And I've only just moved into a house again the other week. I'm starting to look into stationary jobs at this point. Luckily, I do have a job training that I finished like 3 years back as a lab assistant, actually.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Which, to be honest, is a pretty good job to have that pays fairly well. I really want to do everything possible not to do that for 40 hours a week because it absolutely sucks the life out of you to sit in a lab 8 hours a day in like a sterile white room.
It's the complete opposite of what we're used to.
Oh, absolutely. There's a reason I never worked in that job again after the job training.
Sure.
I swore to myself that I would never, ever go back into this job, but this year's kind of changed everything.
Yeah, the options kind of run out.
Exactly. And the other thing that I'm trying to look into in order not to have to sit in the lab for a full 8 hours a day is I'm kind of trying to get a little more into the, marketing / PR side of music a little bit more and try to like offer that to probably not artists right now, but more like bigger labels and like sort of like bigger, more established companies in music in some way. And yeah, I don't know, like trying to make it into that. Have you kind of like tried similar before to branch out into different parts of the music industry that do not have to be touring?
Oh yeah, I've done a whole bunch of different stuff. When I was still in college, I worked well as a cocktail server at a 2500 cap venue here. I was a production assistant at a 1200 cap venue and wound up temporarily being an office assistant and a promoter rep there. I interned at a recording studio when I was in college. I just will kind of do whatever is available. I love it all.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I'm going after as well. The other day I wrote up a bunch of different CVs that are all kind of for a specific job and kind of like a specific wording for a specific agency or whatever I would do.
Definitely.
I mean, at this point, I'm honestly even applying for unpaid internships just to kind of get my foot in the door. And I'm also considering literally kind of sending cold emails to friends of mine and like bands that I work with and just be like, hey, I want to try this new venture. Are you going to let me, I don't know, handle your social media for like a month or two and see how it goes? And if it goes well, we can talk about more, something like that. But I haven't completely thought it through yet. I just really want to do everything possible to keep the lab assistant hours down as much as I can.
Yeah, I've been doing the same kind of thing where you have to, I don't know if our cover letters as big of a thing in Europe as they seem to be.
Not really, no. I've never really understood cover letters much at all, to be honest. Like, I've been receiving a bunch of CVs and cover letters from mostly US people in the past whenever I've had positions open at restaurant booking.
Yeah.
And I've always been so annoyed by all of these cover letters.
It's like, awful. I hate them.
I'm not going to read through like 7 paragraphs of like shit that you just write as a kind of, I mean, all right, I'm being a little bit mean right now, but like, I'm not going to read through 7 paragraphs that you kind of put together through like capitalist phrases that work with major companies or whatever. Like, I'm not going to read that. I want to see a nice CV. And like, if I know one or two artists that you work with, you're probably in.
Yeah, cover letters, it's just like, I feel like every time I have to write one, it feels like the first time. And it makes you feel like such a phony. Yes. At least it makes me feel like such a phony of just being like, yes, here is how good I am and why you should hire me. It's like, just call me. Let's talk about it.
Yes, exactly.
But I've been, as of this month, finally starting to also apply for stationary jobs and like kind of anywhere.
Yeah.
Any of the stuff that I want to do isn't really available in Philly. And, you know, I don't feel very tied to being here anyway. I've been here for like 8 years. I like it, but when you travel as much as people like us do and you see so many other places,
yeah,
it makes it really tempting to move somewhere else. So
I did just pull off a whole move, like, from, I mean, it's not that big a deal in the end, but I've been living mostly stationary in Germany, where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially last year, I kind of left the country to just be on tour forever.
Yeah.
And that lasted for about a year. And then the pandemic hit, and I completely unplanned ended up relocating to Austria, which is a very beautiful country. I never ever planned on being here, but I'm just saying, I fully get the point of when you travel a lot, it's kind of harder to put up with your hometown.
Yeah, there's something wistful about it. And, you know, in Philly, a lot of the houses are row homes, so their city blocks are just like every house is attached to every other house.
Yeah.
And every time I leave and go somewhere else, I'm like, oh, I really want to live in a home that isn't attached to other homes.
Are there any places that you've kind of been looking at? Any place that you really want to go and live?
In theory, I mean, I like Nashville. I like Chicago. I like Austin. I actually spent the summer, my parents live in upstate New York, and I was there helping take care of my grandfather, and I like that area a lot. They're around Rochester, mm-hmm. New York, and even though I was born there, I didn't really grow up there, so it was strange to be back there for 3 months as like an adult and experience it that way. But I, at this point, I will go where a job is.
I see, yeah. To kind of go back to the tour managing.
Sure.
So a friend of mine asked me this question at the beginning of the year, and I wasn't quite sure what to answer to it, but I would be interested in what you're going to say about it. So my question is, do you think you have a specific tour management style? Like, do you have a specific set of like programs or like apps that you use? Do you have a specific approach to how you work with an artist and how you advance shows? What's kind of the base of how you do tour management and merch management as well?
Sure. Well, I think one of my strengths as a tour manager is that I'm pretty mutable. I don't come into working with an artist with a very rigid sense of how things need to be done. I like to get a vibe for the people that I'm working with and see what's going to work for both of us.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of spreadsheets. Google Sheets is where I live my life.
Yes.
I'll use Master Tour if like an artist I'm working for has it, but it's not something that I'm personally paying for because I don't think it's necessary. I like make my own like tour book in Google Docs, and I'll send out individual day sheets. I tend to try to advance the shows for all the bands on tour if I'm tour managing the headliner, mm-hmm. Just because I think it makes it easier so that everybody's in the loop for the information.
Yes.
And I'll send day sheets to the support bands,
yes,
the night before the next day so that they always have the information. And as far as merch managing goes, I just think it's really important to get to know the audience. Looking at the numbers is really important, but the numbers don't mean anything without context. So, for example, on my second tour with Japanese Breakfast, I noticed that a bunch of people were asking for extra small size shirts, but we didn't sell them. So I started tallying the number of people who asked for them. And then I brought that to the manager at the end of the run and said, hey, we need to start ordering shirts this size, even though it's annoying for me to have to find a place for another item.
Yeah.
Because look at what we're maybe losing. And like with the Japanese Breakfast crowd, they might be willing to get the small, even if it's not what they wanted. But with a different crowd, if you don't have what they want, they're not going to buy something else. So you need to like be aware, yeah, of the people who you're servicing.
Yeah, I've experienced that too. I haven't done any specific merch management type of jobs for artists that I was being paid for,
mm-hmm.
but I've been touring kind of like everywhere in the last couple of years myself as a performer, and I've always sold my own merch, and I've definitely experienced that kind of thing, that with like different crowds come different. I mean, this sounds a little out of place right now, but like, I guess customer behavior.
Yeah, but that's what it is. Like at the end of the day, I know we don't like to to talk about it that way in the music industry, but
yes,
they are your customers. Like, they're your fans, but they're also your customers.
Yep.
And as such, like, because we care more in certain ways, or at least some artists do, and I do, you need to be in tune with what your fans slash customers want.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I think that's really big, that I feel certain bigger artists and or their merch tables and merch managers are lacking sometimes, is the consideration into creating a certain atmosphere
mm-hmm.
about the space where you sell merch. Like, and I mean, this is kind of an obvious one, but it's mostly like male bands where I see that a merch table is just kind of doesn't have a lot of creativity to it, let alone the graphic designs. And especially when you're doing merch at like a DIY house show run,
mm-hmm.
then yeah, you gotta sell loads more merch if you have some couple of nice string lights. Especially like last year, I've done a full US run giving talks and workshops and stuff like that. We did like 40 shows or something over 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And about halfway, somebody basically gave us a stack of like information material. And I could definitely tell that people were so much more interested in the merch afterwards. And as soon as a person looks at like a cool little self-help scene or something, they are far more likely to buy a t-shirt as well.
Yeah, well, because they're spending more time looking at it. You know, they're standing at the table holding the informational zine.
Sure.
And while they're glancing through it, they're also looking at your merch. And that's great. Like, I think we need to move past this idea that it's bad to make money doing something you want to be doing. It's expensive to be on the road. It's like gas, there's tolls. If you can't find a person to stay with, there's hotels. It's like at every level, selling merch is vitally important for the survival of a band. Bands don't make a lot of money off ticket sales.
Yes.
They're not making the same kind of money off of people paying for their music because streaming numbers are bullshit. Can I curse on this?
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm just like surprised that I haven't dropped a fuck yet. So it's like,
that's all right. Go for it.
So merch is important. And when artists care about the merch and what it looks like and how it represents them, it is obvious. And it sells better as a result.
For sure.
Japanese Breakfast and Mannequin Pussy both in particular, I know, are really selective about who makes their designs and what the colors and like whether it's going to be printed on a long sleeve or a hoodie and,
yes.
and the like yes. little items. Like, we'll, you know, I'll talk to them about it and we'll come up with things that fit. I mean, they take like a big lead, but when they consult me, like I'll give my opinion based on who we're selling to. And when we're doing reorders on stuff throughout the run, like we'll talk about it. And you can tell based on the numbers we move, even when they're a support band,
that it works out.
Yeah.
Like I was thinking about this the other day, how often bands have these really interchangeable, straight up boring, typical kind of like hardcore punk t-shirts. You know, you've got the logo on like the left front and you got a big logo on the back, and the t-shirt is either mm-hmm. black print on white or white print on black. And it's like, guys, can you be a little creative? Like I was thinking today, DIY and the music industry in general needs more crop tops. I would buy all the crop
tops. Yes, more crop tops. Coping Skills has joked about bringing a pair of scissors with us on tour specifically to like crop shirts for people at the table.
I have like 70 Quest Front t-shirts sitting around in my van that I haven't been able to sell because all the tours this year got cancelled.
Oh.
And I was thinking, like, is it a thing that you can do to like literally hand crop the t-shirts and still sell them? Or is it like a really shit thing to do? It could backfire.
Well, you could, in theory, I don't know how crafty you're trying to get, but you could crop them and hem them yourself.
Yeah,
something to think about. I don't know, it's complicated because it depends on what a person's looking for in a crop top. I make a lot of my own crop tops, and it depends on the shirt as to how far I'm gonna crop it and like where
that's
the
true.
Design
yes.
sits.
Yes.
So it's just a tough gamble.
Exactly, that's a good point. Either way, I love that we're talking about crop tops a lot right now.
I love crop tops. Like, especially a muscle crop top. Maybe what you could do is, like, put them up online and crop one to take pictures of so that, like, it's a suggestion. It's like a, hey, this is a great shirt. Would also make a great crop top. And, you know, if you want to do that.
Oh, that's actually a really good idea. I might do that, yeah.
And you're just, like, planting the seed of the idea to help sell it.
Heck yes. Another thing that I feel like would run great as merch, like sort of short running pants with print on the butt.
Yeah.
I would so buy that. I love wearing running shorts.
Yeah. I feel like that was really big in like the early 2010s with like pop rock bands.
True. Yeah, no, it's true. And like, I feel like a great trendsetter could be Phoebe Bridgers. Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure whether she's done running shorts. She probably has, but she's got these great sweatpants with all the bones on it, but also Phoebe Bridgers on the butt in like a metal sort of font.
Nice.
And I think that's such a great merch idea.
Yeah.
I'm so into that. Either way, so another thing that I wanted to ask you about tour management again. Quiz front booking, the whole deal that we have, aside from only working with marginalized artists, is that we strongly advocate for creating safer spaces for inclusivity, for accessibility, and for accountability. Those are kind of like the four principles that we do have, that we work a lot on. And obviously that reflects strongly in our relationship with both promoters and artists and kind of what we ask of them,
mm-hmm.
and specifically what we ask of promoters, but also what we ask of an artist and the way that we communicate and kind of like the measures that we take in order to make every show and the whole touring environment as safe as possible for each person. Are there any, I guess, specific policies that you have? Is there anything that you write into your contracts? But yeah, how do you approach the whole like creating safe spaces, accountability, accessibility, inclusivity? How do you kind of approach these four points, both with promoters and with artists?
It's a really good question. Again, I have to say that I've been fairly lucky that all of the artists I've worked for, it hasn't been an issue. They're all like really great folks who are aware of creating spaces that are inclusive and diverse and safe. And maybe this is something that I need to look into and reconsider next time I go out on the road, but it isn't even something that I've really had to think about or haven't really thought about because we have been, or I have been so fortunate. You know, I'll, when I'm advancing, I'll send out information on the members and all of our pronouns. Mm-hmm. And like, I make sure to ask about that before I start working with somebody so that I know going in.
Yes.
But it just really hasn't been something that's been an issue in my personal experience, fortunately.
I'm really glad that it hasn't.
And as you were talking about that, like the only experience now that comes to mind that I've had on tour of like a lack of safety wasn't even with the band or the crew or the venue. It was with the bus driver. And
oh, yeah.
And I was with a band of all cis dudes. It was 10 cis dudes and me. And they're lovely boys. I love them. But, you know, it's a different environment, which again, like, you have to adapt to.
Yes.
And the bus driver was showing not just me, but first me specifically and then other people this weird text meme. It was like a dick pic. And it was just very uncomfortable. I mean, the guy himself was kind of uncomfortable to be around, but this was the furthest it got into like, this is really inappropriate and you shouldn't be doing this in your workplace. And at first, you know, I didn't know how to react to it and kind of walked away. And later, either that day or within a couple of days, one of the crew members actually confronted him. Like, that's really fucked up. You're not going to do anything like that the rest of the tour. Like, you're going to sit down, drive the bus, and just that's it.
Yeah.
And so, like, even then, the boys kind of, I always just call them the boys. You know, they rallied and did the right thing, recognizing that it's a band of seven men. For every tour, they try to make sure that they're bringing on somebody who isn't also a band of all men.
That's really good. That's really good.
Yeah. It's the Whitney Boys. So like the tours that I did with them, I only merch managed for Whitney, but I wouldn't even have to have, you know, the conversation. They're already like recognizing and doing what they feel responsible to do to create inclusive spaces.
That's really good. Like following the experiences that we've had, a thing that we've done recently is we've added a clause to our artist contracts that basically says, if you engage in any discriminatory behavior, if you do a violent thing against minorities, then this contract will be terminated immediately and refunds may not be given. So that's kind of like a pretty strong clause to include in a contract, but the whole team feels that that's a really good way to, I guess, like already sort of seed out an artist that might cause trouble.
Yeah.
You know, when an artist would see this contract and like say, all right, you know what, we're not going to work together, then we quite probably dodged a bullet, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's really smart to have that in there. And it protects you all from future to protect Queers to the Front booking from working with artists like that again.
Yeah. Another thing that we do is over the last 2 years that we have existed, we've written together a quite solid safer space policy. It's basically, at this point, probably like a four-page PDF, and we will literally send this to every single promoter that is interested in booking an artist that we represent. And it will include loads of ideas on how to create a safe space at the show, but also loads of requirements and conditions that we have in order to accept the show.
Sure.
Like a ground rule that we have is we will only accept a show if there's unisex bathrooms. Kind of a bit more of a soft line is venue accessibility. We understand that sometimes it's super, super difficult to find wheelchair accessible venues, especially in certain cities, certain areas. It is really difficult, but it's something that we work for really hard to make sure that we get venues that are accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we also send out the pronouns of the touring party, what you were mentioning as well. There's a bunch of ideas that we bring in. Oh yeah, and another solid rule, another hard rule that we have is that we will only accept supports for the show if they have at least one marginalized person in the band.
Great.
I feel like that is generally a really solid way to do it. We actually have one promoter making problems out of it. I remember it was like a bar, it was a dive bar in Poland, I think. And the promoter got really angry when I sent him the documents over and said like, hey, I know you want to book supports, but please do make sure it's not like an all-male band. And so he got really angry and proceeded to go on like a rant, essentially saying, at our venue, we don't do discrimination like that. And we don't choose artists because of their gender. Artists play at our venue because of the music quality. And I was like, I'm not sure you understand my point. And then a week later, he gets back to me and goes like, hey, I found a support band. It's five white dudes and they play metalcore. And it's like, do you queer bands from the US?
of course it is. God, I just, why are people like this? You know, like that's, anytime I hear something like that, I'm just so willfully ignorant. It's beyond me.
True. I feel like maybe there's so many experiences we've made for Queers to the Front, specifically it's because we have a booking front. I do feel like as a tour manager, you're kind of more removed from that.
Definitely.
And the shit will probably hit the promoter first and more so, and maybe the artist a little bit, but I feel like as a tour manager, you're quite often more removed from the action as the job title sounds like. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, you're kind of stuck with your lot in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, at my point of involvement or at any tour manager's point of involvement, the shows are booked. So it's like the venues are chosen, the support bands are there, and you have to just deal with the fallout of whatever that means.
Yes.
And, you know, you have your share of experiences of being at a venue or even beforehand trying to advance a show with a person who is just wildly uncommunicative or really drops the ball on their job. but as far as a lot of the stuff that's in your contract for booking a show ahead of time, like all of that's been decided or not by the time, you know, a tour manager steps in.
I mean, you don't need to talk shit on anybody, obviously, but like, have you ever had experiences where you got a job on a tour and you kind of wonder how or why the booking agent did do that, like routing specific venues, specific bands? Have you ever kind of had experiences like that where you kind of scratch your head a little bit and went like, hey, who had the idea for this tour?
Oh, definitely. And it's usually just small stuff, you know, a shitty promoter here who tries to convince you at the show what a good guy he is, even though he like didn't bring anybody out and wouldn't advance the show with you and try to tell you how things are done when he was wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had experiences of just like looking at a contract, or not even really a contract, just, you know, a deal memo.
Yes.
Rolling up to the show and being like, oh, I think the booking agent really dropped the ball here. You know, why am I paying for loaders and a sound engineer when there are no loaders?
Yeah.
Like, I know you're not paying the sound engineer double, so why is this coming out of my pocket?
Mm.
But it's important for the tour manager to be on the ball about stuff like that, because, you know, in the specific example of where we were at a venue, I was looking at the contract, we were slotted to pay for loaders and a sound engineer when there were no loaders. We loaded all of our gear in, and the deal itself I thought wasn't very good because we were hardly going to make any more money at sellout than we would if we had sold zero tickets. So,
oh wow.
Yeah, so I had said, I'd gotten in contact with our booking agent and with the promoter, and, you know, of course at this level of show the promoter wasn't there, so I was supposed to settle with a security guard, which is fine, but, you know, it's nothing against security guards, but they have no authority to work out a change in the deal.
Yes.
But because I had been on top of this early in the day, like before doors, by the time the show was almost over and we had sold it out, or within a couple, no, we sold it out. The general manager came over and talked to me and was like, hey, I'm going to work out a sellout bonus because this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so I got my band more money because I was on my shit.
Yes. I have another question about, like, it sounds like you've tour managed tours and, like, basically you've done shows and tours that definitely exceeded the general, like, DIY house show kind of run, haven't you? Like,
yes.
You have worked with bands that fill out, like, 300, 400 upwards cap rooms.
Mm-hmm.
I personally haven't so far. Everything I've done has always been within the realm of DIY kind of stuff. I've kind of felt stuck in that a little bit. I mean, I know that I've built my nest because with Chris Front Booking and our policy that we only work with marginalized artists, that kind of means we're setting ourselves up to fail financially, because like most of those people are not going to be able to pay us a whole lot of money, because most of the artists that will reach out to us will be people that just don't have a lot of money due to structural reasons. And also a lot of the artists that will reach out to us will be very young queer bands that are just starting out. So many artists have told us in the past they never thought that touring was an actual option to them, because they just never really seen somebody set up safe for touring and like actually care about marginalized communities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And especially in Europe, where I started the whole thing, I've always noticed that there are loads of like feminist booking collectives and stuff like that, but what was always missing was the link that would link all of these venues and like booking collectives in each city. Like, nobody really had the connections and like a database of all of them, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And so that's where we came in and started doing that. And so many bands reached out and were like, hey, we never thought touring was possible, but now it seems it is, so we're going to go with you, but we have no money because we're very small artists. And that's what it's always been. And that's perfect, because that's ethically and politically what I want to do and what we want to do. But that's not a way to ever make this financially sustainable. And I personally have kind of felt a little bit stuck a lot recently, where I really want to get myself more into I'm just going to say more commercial shows.
Yeah.
Or just bigger shows where artists will be able to pay a little bit more money because paying rent is nice.
Yeah.
I can't forever work with DIY bands doing their first tour because then I've just got to be a lap assistant and a hobby tour manager. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
What do you think is the way to do that? Like, how do you feel? How did it happen? How did you kind of shift from DIY touring into 400 cap rooms? How did that happen?
Mannequin Pussy. I think I've just been sort of lucky that they chose me when they did. The first tour I did with them, well, I should say Mannequin Pussy and just like continually proving myself. But the first tour I did with them was their record release DIY tour for Romantic. And then while we were on that run, they got asked to do a support tour for Joyce Manor and AJJ.
Oh, wow.
So I tour managed Mannequin Pussy on that run. And then I did a few more runs with them. They did a weekend run to do Pooza Fest in Canada. And then we did a support tour with Cherry Glazer. And then we did a tour where they were second of three supporting Japanese Breakfast. And this was the Soft Sounds for Another Planet tour. Marissa and Michelle are good friends. And Michelle asked Marissa if I would be willing to sell merch for Japanese Breakfast as well. So for 5 weeks, I tour managed and sold merch for Mannequin Pussy, and I sold merch for Japanese Breakfast.
That is a hell of a job.
Yes.
Did you ever sleep?
A little. It was like, you know, just me manning the table for most of the show. And then as soon as Japanese Breakfast were done, Michelle and their bassist tour manager, Devin, would come over to the table, and Devin would kind of take over selling their merch for a bit.
Sure.
And then I would focus on Mannequin Pussy stuff. And once the Mannequin Pussy line was kind of over with, I would help sell Japanese Breakfast stuff again. So it was a lot of work, but it was worth it because then Japanese Breakfast wanted to keep hiring me. And so I started touring with them. And because I did a good job for them, they're managed by this guy, Ryan, who owns a management company called 10 Atoms. And Ryan hired me to tour manage and do merch for Bully on a support tour with Lord Huron. And since I did a good job for Bully and he needed a merch person for Whitney, he hired me to sell merch for Whitney. And because they liked me, they kept bringing me back. And so It really is just a combination of working with the right folks and doing a good job with them, because people definitely talk and will keep passing you around when they like you.
True. Honestly, congratulations. I feel like you're doing a great, fantastic job. And I feel like the whole process that you just kind of laid out, I think that is a testament to really good work you are doing.
Thank you.
I would honestly love to see you tour managing in action, be a little shadow, something like that. That'd be cool. This year, I was fairly booked out, honestly. And there was loads of artists that were ready to take me on their tour for like a month as a tour manager and a driver, and also rent the entire music equipment and the van to them.
Yeah.
And like do all of these things at once.
Yeah. Well, and it comes back to, you know, something we were talking about earlier, where it's like, it sounds like you were set up to have a pretty successful year with Course to the Front booking and with tour managing. And then it was taken all away, the same way that like my year of tour managing booked out was also taken all away, and there's nothing you could do about it.
No, it feels like you haven't gotten all of these commissions in the first place.
Exactly.
Because in many cases, I quite literally had to pay back the commissions to the artists. Because like what we do for tour managing services, especially for like van rental, backline rental, stuff that kind of includes a lot of money and like expensive equipment, let me put it like that.
Sure.
We will take a 50% commission that is to be transferred to us if you want to confirm the tour and sign the contract. And the other 50% are due after the first week of the tour, when basically the artists have met us and seen it's not a scam and like the van has not broken apart at first look.
Sure.
And so after the first week of the tour, which I think is a pretty fair deal, and also a way for us to survive better, and also a way for me as the founder of Quiz Front to actually somewhat pay the 9 other people on the team that are there at this point and mostly working on commission as well. Yeah, either way, like, since I literally had to pay back some of these 50% commissions, aka large sums of money,
right,
it really feels like all of these artists that were going to work with me and signed contracts already were never really there. So it feels like my brain is stuck in 2019 in a weird way.
Yeah, I have the same experience where at least in April, it looked like the tours were getting rebooked for later this year.
Yes.
And now that those tours that I had keep getting pushed further and further into oblivion, it's like they never were going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, true. And like most of these tours that got rebooked into like fall or whatever are now cancelled for good. And like only a very few very brave artists have pushed stuff into 2021. And I can already tell that it's not going to happen. 100% it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Especially not a single US band has got a tour Europe in at least 12 months. Take my word on it.
Yeah, and if you're saying that, where at least you're having more success overall as like a continent containing the virus, I mean, the United States response has been so disgraceful.
Yes.
If we're not even going there, like we're definitely not being able to tour our own country. And that's not even to say anything about the big crisis that's facing independent venues. They're all at risk of closing because no legislation has been passed to support them financially.
Yes.
This whole entire time. I mean, the National Independent Venue Association has been working to fight Congress to get some sort of funding, but many of these independent venues like are not going to be able to keep covering their overhead without any income. And a lot of them cannot open safely and they don't have the support cushion that like yes. Live Nation venues have.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Live Nation announced opening a new venue in Philly like last month. And I was like, read the room. It's so rude.
Yeah,
you know? And so who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what's going to be left? There's already venues that I like in this country that have closed because of the pandemic. And it's just heartbreaking.
We've had a couple artists reach out to us again throughout the last couple of weeks, being like, hey, QuizFront, yes, we had a tour for 2020. Yes, we had to cancel it. Any word whether we might be able to push it into 2021? And we've had some discussions on the team, and even European mainland is not ready for any touring whatsoever. The only thing that we might look into are like a handful special outdoor distance shows, something like that maybe, but like with a big question mark to it. And anything concerning UK tours, which we were asked about as well, is also a big no-no because the UK has probably had the worst response to the corona outbreak in all of Europe. Plus they're leaving the EU towards the end of this year for good, and it's looking like a whole no deal thing with just borders closing.
Yeah.
There's already medication shortages in the US and the UK and a bunch of other stuff. So loads of UK venues, especially DIY venues, have closed their doors in many cases forever throughout the last couple of weeks. And many more are going to follow. Like, even if touring comes back in like 12 months or whatever, the infrastructure to work with is not going to be the same again. I wonder whether it's ever going to be the same again, but maybe that's also just because I'm a little pessimist and just read an article called "The American Democracy is going to End in 60 Days."
I would love to read that. Well, I would both love and hate to read that article because it is...
It's a really good one. It's a really,
really
good one.
Scary times here.
Yes.
I wake up and I wonder how other people are seeing the same things that I'm seeing and being like, this is fine. It is boggling to me.
It's the whole dualism of the human mind, I guess. Like, to be honest, in a way, I did catch myself a little bit on that the other week, because since I'm living in Austria, this is one of the European countries where the infection numbers have pretty much the entire time have been at a very moderate, controllable, workable level, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they've only recently gone up a significant amount, but like in the international comparison, still very mild, right?
Right.
And I definitely pretty much went back to life kind of normal. And like, I did meet loads of friends and I did fully let my guard drop. And I kind of told myself that it was fine, because the 6 months before that, I'd been in more or less total isolation, which also led me to quite literally the worst physical and mental place I've been in my entire life. Mm-hmm. Like, quite a dangerous one at that, unfortunately. And so I told myself that it was fine to do that. And at the same time, I kind of pointed the finger a little bit too much, maybe. And like, whatever thing I would hear, I would always be like, oh yeah, but that's the thing that happens in the US or the UK and like all of these places with horrible countries, horrible governments. And I'm fine in Austria because, you know, it's not that big a deal here. And then 2 weeks ago, one of my best friends here got a positive corona test.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, this whole dichotomy in my mind got shattered. And all of a sudden, this full sense of security was just gone. And like, the rock had been pulled below my feet. And like, I started to feel like this sinking feeling in the stomach. And started to realize that I'd been letting myself slip too much. And that it's quite easy to just point the finger like these other nations, horrible governments and like corona responses or whatever, and just be like, yeah, even if your numbers are mild, people are still dying and it is still a thing that affects marginalized communities the worst. And like, was it really necessary to hang out with your friends in a closed room the other day, even if you were wearing masks? I'm just saying, it is very easy to fall into that trap and be like, oh yeah, this doesn't affect me.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. And, you know, I'm glad to hear that you were able to get through that period a few months ago, because isolation really does horrible things to all of us. Humans are social creatures. Like, as punishment, we block people in solitary confinement. Like, there's a reason isolation is dangerous. I was listening to something about this in the last couple of months, but like, the longer you're exposed to a risk, like, we know the coronavirus risk itself hasn't really changed, but our fear of it has gone down because we're so used to it.
Exactly.
And so it takes something like your friend getting diagnosed to be like, oh shit, this is real still.
Yes.
But I get it. You know, I've also let my guard slip a little bit in the past month or two because I need to be around my people.
Yes.
But there's still the fear, like, you still have to remember. It's like, you just can't do it all the time. You can't completely go back to normal. And what I kind of was referring to with how are people seeing this and going, this is fine, I more mean just like everything the Donald Trump administration does and stands for. You know, that's really where I almost can't believe that this country has allowed ourselves to slip so far, but it doesn't happen overnight. It is a series of small but still large transgressions that you're like, okay, and then it just becomes business as usual to have a person like him in office being like joking about extending to a third term, which is not allowed to happen, or saying in an interview that he knew how dangerous it was but it didn't tell us, and that being just fine. And then within an hour of, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg dying, saying, yeah, we're going to try to push forth another Supreme Court justice within a month. And despite like the total hypocrisy of Mitch McConnell on that, when they withheld a nomination from Obama's administration in 2016. But people just don't care. And I see this even in my own family. Like, I had a really big falling out with my brother last month about the big Trump flag that he had on his house. And we didn't speak for like a month.
Wow.
But I'm trying to get him to understand like the physical danger that this administration makes me feel all the time.
Yeah.
And it's hard to explain that to people who are not having the experiences you're having and are believing rhetoric that doesn't even reflect their own experiences. It's like a double sword.
I do think I've got to send you the article later.
Yeah, please do.
Does it sound weird to say that it's sometimes helped to kind of go to the extreme and really say, like, oh, yeah, it is the end of literal democracy approaching it. This is literal fascism, and like looking at 2020 and what's been happening globally, both on a political and environmental level, to just go like, yeah, this is the beginning of the end. And this is just the warm up for what the next decade is going to look like for us.
That's what it feels like.
There's something really comforting in that. Sounds very weird and like distorted, I know, but like there is the comfort in darkness that you know that there is going to be light. There's this writer called Rachel Solnit.
Oh, yeah, I've read her.
Yes. She essentially has like this phrase that she had in a book called "The future is dark, but in darkness we see constellation."
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure whether I get the quote exactly right, but that is something that I heard about in like 2015 when friends of mine in a band called Petra Girls released a record kind of like based around that theme, like "In the darkness we see constellation."
Mm-hmm.
In kind of like the same sort of the same way I've started the habit of listening to Phoebe Bridgers' very apocalyptic, dystopic "I Know the End" every time before going to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Like I literally listen to that at this point to help me sleep.
Wow.
Which is twisted, but there's comfort in darkness and just kind of admitting, like, it's not about like talking about hypocrisy of Mitch McConnell anymore. Because yeah, it's shit, but like we all know at this point that these people in like the Republican Senate, like they do not give a shit and they never have.
Right.
They're just taking off the mask, quite literally. No pun intended.
Yeah.
Like it is not about that anymore. It's like I read a quote somewhere today also was about like this essentially you are not gonna uphold these changes that are happening by pointing the finger at the illegality of doing a third term or something like that.
Right.
Like, the hypocrisy of Mitch McConnell, he's never going to care. Like, he never has cared and he will never care. None of these Republicans do. It is like Joe Biden appealing to Republican senators that, like, to their consciousness. Which consciousness? They are already following their consciousness.
Right.
Which is what Trevor Noah said today. Like, they are following their consciousness. That's what they do. They do not give a shit. Like, they want power. They want money. That's all they do. And they've always done. So what are we talking about? Like, the morality in the Republican politics of the government. Like, it's not about that. It's the literal end of democracy in 60 days. And, like, sometimes it's good to just really look that dystopia in the eye and realize it is already there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point about the appealing to which consciousness is like you think that you can reach somebody on your level, but they are just like they're not even in the same field.
Yes, they want to.
They don't have the same realm of consciousness. And like I've said this a lot, but you know, the problem with there's a lot of problems with the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party, it gets so comparative to the Republican Party, gets so nitpicky about individual things and just like they have so much fighting with each other. And on top of that, trying to appeal to people who aren't even in their base, that they can't get their own base excited. They're just like not even, you know, garnering support from people who will support them because they have no choice, but you're not going to be excited about it. Like, I don't know anybody who's thrilled to vote for Joe Biden. They're just going to do it because look at the alternative. Whereas the Republican Party can get over their differences and come together just so that they'll win. Like they don't give two shits about anything in the same way that Democrats pretend to.
Yes.
It's asinine. Like how did we end up with Joe Biden over like candidates that people were actually excited about? It's bonkers. It's like they've set up the system for their own demise by trying to appeal to the right who are just going to stick with Trump almost no matter what at this point. Like
exactly.
It's so so stupid.
It is true what he said these years back, a couple of years back. I could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and people would still celebrate me. And it's
exactly
true.
Exactly.
It is
1,000%.
True.
I mean,
it's
true. It's the same as people tweeting their support for Kyle Rittenhouse.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how do you see this action and applaud it? You know, this minor crossed state lines, killed two people, returned home, was peacefully apprehended.
And he still didn't show up for the court date. Like, he didn't show up for his second court date, too, now.
But it's just fine, you know? It's like, I just don't understand how I'm living in the same reality as other people.
I guess, like, the only problem with my whole, I guess, let's call it a coping mechanism of being like, oh, yeah, the end is already here. Like, this is quite literally society collapsing, what we see right now. Like, this year is literally the warm-up for the collapse of, like, at least the Northwestern Hemisphere society.
Yeah.
That is what it is. But the problem with that is, what does it actually change? Like, I mean, the only thing it does change for me, I guess, to answer my own question, is it gives me maybe a little bit more energy because I get a little bit more confident and I stop stressing out about like hypocrisy and like morality in people that will never and have never had and never wanted to have a consciousness in the first place. So I don't stress out about that anymore, and I don't care in a way. But like, what does it change? Like, I probably think about that every single day, but how if you can't appeal to another person's consciousness, how are you ever going to appeal to them? And like, even if you try to answer in a voice that they understand, which is violence, they're still going to gaslight you and like tear bomb you and like all of these things. How are you ever going to change something for a person that truly, truly doesn't care about what the next human next to them is going to endure and endure? That is what this writer in this article, Democracy, American Democracy Dies in 60 Days, was also saying. The only way that not just America, but like Northwestern Hemisphere society in general, as in the societies on the planet that do not have collectivist ideas, such as a lot of Asian countries, for example, but individualist ideals. If we do not stop, if like these parts of the globe do not stop with these completely individualist way of living, society is literally gonna fall apart because, like, capitalism is just in the late stage about to eat itself up. But I still haven't answered the question, but I don't think anybody has.
Yeah, I don't think it's really an answerable question. What I will say is, like, until the system collapses, we can't rebuild it.
True.
So, you know, this, everything that's going on here will not be fixed from the inside because it's functioning as was designed. You know,
yes.
It's not meant to be any different than it is. And,
yes.
And so it's like moving past that idea in the same way that you're moving past the idea that these people even care about their own hypocrisy or can be
yes.
appealed to based on that kind of morality. I don't know how you would even find the answer of, well, so what then? You know, what do we do next?
I also just had a little look on the clock. And we've been talking for forever, which is really nice. I enjoy this. The question that I always go for at the end is, after all of this talk about, all of this conversation about isolation, the pandemic, the dark future, what is something that you have learned from 2020 and all of its situations? What is kind of your lesson in this year? Is there maybe like a major coping. I was going to say skill, but then I was going to go for...
You can say it. It's okay.
Coping strategy that you've learned from this year. Yeah, is there something that you really take to move forward from these last 9 months? Big question, I know.
Yeah, I would say that it's always the right time to start something that you want to do. In May, I decided that I wanted to learn how to skateboard. I am 27 years old, so it is maybe not the right age to start learning how to skateboard.
Never too late.
It's never too late. And it's been really great for me because I am a person who has a lot of fear of failure and often stops from even starting tasks because of that.
Yes.
And in skateboarding, you have to be bad to get good. There is just no being good at it. You have to fall,
yes.
You have to make mistakes, and you have to get up and try again. I've decided this year that, you know, with touring coming back, who knows when, I am going to take the LSATs and maybe go to law school. That's something that I've thought I would do, but not till my 40s. So mm-hmm. I was like, well, if I'm not going to be on the road and I'm going to be at home, might as well just give it a whirl now. I mean, we started the podcast last year, but we really started putting it out and getting the ball rolling with More Talk, Less Rock. And it has been such a wonderful learning experience, just like starting that task and really going for that. And yeah, trying new things has been really important to keep me motivated this year. So I guess that's what I've taken away from it. A lot of people I know have been re-finding activities or like just general enjoyment pursuits that they were really interested in their youth, and like rediscovering that and actually going for it as an adult. And I think that's kind of beautiful. So
it is.
It's just like the time is always now.
That's such a really good point to round up the podcast here. And I'll add to that, I've also learned a lot of these sentiments that you were just saying, not sentiments, more like lessons.
Mm-hmm.
I have actually fully reverted back to being a 12-year-old kid in the last weeks, as in I used to be really big at like soccer, and like team sports with balls and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It is weird because it's kind of like another part of my life where I wasn't out as a trans woman yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I am kind of taking back all of the enjoyment and excitement I used to find in like team sports before I had to stop everything due to coming out and not fitting in with the binary anymore.
Sure.
But yeah, I recently have started a soccer crew here in Austria with loads of women and non-binary people. And a few men that I do really like, just to say it. because people always call me man-hater and like that. Anyways, it's been so much fun. And like the other day I bought a soccer ball and like I rode my bike to the store. And I bought the soccer ball and then I rode home with the soccer ball like on the back of the bike.
Uh-huh.
And I really felt like 12 years old again because that was like the whole deal. That was what I was doing every single day. Just like riding around with the soccer ball on the back. It's been so much fun. And that act in itself has opened so many doors to me. And I really truly forgot what enjoyment running after a stupid ball brings. It is so much fun. We play every Sunday now, and it's the best day of the week. And I wonder where soccer has been all of these years. So,
you just get bogged down in other stuff. Like, you know, you get older and there's all of these different responsibilities being tacked on and different life experiences that you kind of lose that sense of childlike joy. And because everybody's been forced to stop, I think we've all gotten a chance, or many people, I shouldn't say, not everybody's really had the chance to stop or been forced into the chance to stop. But for those who have, many people are rediscovering what that once was. And I hope that we're able to keep it, you know, like if one good thing comes out of all of this garbage, just being able to keep that more childlike sense of joy would be a really wonderful thing.
That's a really nice point. Rachel, thanks so much for being on the podcast. This has been super enjoyable. Yeah, and if anybody hasn't done so, please check out Rachel's fantastic burden coping skills. Check out the fantastic podcast, More Talk, Less Rock. And yeah, again, thanks so much for being on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Cheers.
That was Coping Skills, I Don't Feel Good About This, their brand new song that was just released yesterday. Thanks so much again for tuning in. If you would like to stay in touch with us too, make sure to subscribe to the podcast, give it a review and give us some feedback. Anyways, that's it from us for today, and I can't wait for you to find out our next incredible guests. We have new episodes out every second Saturday. This has been the Quest Front Podcast. Stay tuned and see you next time.